Hello and welcome to Micropod, your small but perfectly formed podcast. I'm Nancy Mendoza. Today's show covers the Society for Applied Microbiology's annual spring meeting. This year it was in Sheffield and the theme was controlling infection. I spoke to Judith Tanner, a professor of clinical nursing research from De Montfort University and one of the speakers at the meeting. Before we hear about the surprising role bed jackets can play in the fight against infections, she began by explaining how she became interested in surgical site infections from a patient's point of view.
When we work in the hospital, it's all about numbers or percentages, and you never really think about the person. And especially for me, when I was working in the operating room, you know, it's a closed environment. You didn't see what happened on the ward, and you certainly never saw what happened to people, you know, when they were out in the community. So I was interested in what is the patient's experience of a surgical site infection.
We hear quite a lot about people going into hospital and perhaps picking up some sort of infection while they're there. We hear in the news about MRSA and C. diff, and people are very worried about these things. Is that what we're talking about here with a surgical site infection, or is that something different?
No, you've picked up on something really interesting there. Surgical site infections, for example, everyone talks about MRSA, but an MRSA infection could be part of your surgical site infection. So they overlap. Surgical site infections are probably more common than MRSA and C. diff, and they can be just as devastating to patients. The only thing is, the difference with surgical site infections is they don't have that media presence. So you see the newspapers and they've got headlines about superbugs and they talk about dirty hospitals and MRSA and C. diff, but you never see wound infections or surgical site infections. So they don't have that same profile. They're not discussed in the Houses of Parliament in the same way that MRSA would be. So because of that lower awareness and profile, then patients don't know about them. And also probably hospital staff too, they tend not to be so aware. They certainly don't have conversations with patients about, oh, you've got a wound infection. So patients tend not to know.
So how common are they?
Well, there's national data, which is collected by Public Health England. And they say on an average, around 5% of patients who have surgery will end up with a surgical site infection. The only problem is that data is very limited. Probably the main thing with it is that it's collected from patients who are still in hospital, inpatients, and also patients who are readmitted to hospital. But the big problem is most infections present around 13 days after you've had surgery. And 13 days after surgery, most patients have been discharged by then. So they're in the community and they tend not to be readmitted to hospital because of their infection, because we want to keep patients out, because we've got all sorts of, you know, improved facilities in primary care. So we can do intravenous antibiotics, we can cope with complex dressings. We've got tissue viability nurses who work in the community. So when the patients develop, you know, the majority of them develop their infections in primary care, they stay in primary care and the data about them doesn't get back onto that national database. So the national figures of 5%, you know, between, you know, 0.5 and 5% or up to 10% for bowel surgery, they probably underestimate by, it's probably two or three times higher than that. So it's a huge significant problem, especially when you think about the numbers of patients that have surgery, 5 million a year. Another problem with the data is that we don't differentiate between superficial infections and deep infections. Hopefully most superficial infections would be cleared up within 10 days, 2 weeks if you took some antibiotics, but the deep infections are much worse for patients, much more debilitating. And we don't differentiate between, you know, the 5% of infections, what kind of infections they are. So we need to have more information, much better surveillance.
Can you just explain what's the difference between a deep infection and a superficial infection?
So let's say, for example, you had a joint replacement surgery, like a hip replacement or a knee replacement. A deep infection would be an infection that gets in during the operating time itself. So that would be in amongst the, you know, the tissue around perhaps the joint itself. If you get an infection there, then that's really bad news. It's very difficult to treat those infections, to get the blood supply to them with the antibiotics in it. It's very difficult to treat. And the chances are that that prosthesis, the metal work that they've put in, will fail and you'll have to have it removed and a new replacement piece of metal put in, a new joint. And that's going to be hugely problematic for patients. They're going to be off sick for a long time. horrible to have second further surgery. Mm. So deep infections are very debilitating. The superficial infections would be one that you probably see on your skin to begin with. It might be red, inflamed, a bit of, you know, the wound perhaps not healing very effectively. It's not as concerning as the larger, as a deeper infection, but that superficial infection, the bacteria from there can still travel down deeper into the wound where they might cause a deeper infection. So you can't just ignore the superficial infections. They still may cause you to have some time off work or be poorly to begin with, but your worry is that they progress into a deeper infection.
What can we do about this? How can healthcare professionals and patients reduce the likelihood of these infections or perhaps, you know, work together to make sure that the impact of an infection isn't so great and so distressing?
Well, there are lots of things you can do. Surgical site infections are good to target in a way because there are so many risk factors that contribute to them. You know, there must be about 40 or 50. So there's lots of things that you can address. The problem is the two greatest risk factors are what we'd call patient factors. So it's the patient's responsibility. So the biggest one is high body mass index, so patients who are overweight. And then after that, it's smoking. So those are the two to target. But if you work in the acute care, you know, a hospital, it's very difficult if a patient comes in and they need surgery to say, right, you need to lose, you know, a stone by tomorrow, or you need to stop smoking for, you know, 20 days, 30 days before we operate on you. Those are quite hard to implement. There are other things that the hospital concentrate on, and that's about keeping the patient's skin as clean as possible, free from, you know, bacteria that potentially could get in when the wound is open. Keeping the patient warm. Lots of really interesting work coming out about keeping patients warm before the operation. We're quite good at it in the UK about warming them when they're in the operating room, but what we need to get better at is warming them before they go to the operating room. Some of these things patients can really help us with. So, for example, if the patients, they keep warm themselves, they bring, you know, like the little bed jackets your grandma used to wear. So something like that on the ward, keep yourself as warm as possible, keep yourself as clean as possible. A lot of it is about working together with clinicians. So, for example, we have the washes that you get before you come in for surgery. So make sure you wash, you know, you have a shower, preferably rather than a bath, because that's like a soup, you know, bacteria soup. You want to have a shower before you come in. You want to keep as warm as possible, as clean as possible, washing your hands. And then hopefully the hospital will be doing things like, if you're required to have some antibiotics, they give you that at the right time. They keep you warm during the theatre. They prepare your skin with an antiseptic solution before surgery. There are lots and lots of things that we can do, and we can do them together.
How much of that is happening at the moment, do you think?
A lot of those things are happening. Some hospitals have arrangements with the people who commission the healthcare, and they have to record their compliance with some of those interventions. The only problem is you might get 100% compliance, so that you tick every box and you say, yes, all of our patients get warming blankets when they're in the operating theatre. But if you actually walked into an operating theatre and you had a look, you might see that the warming blanket's on, but it's not switched on at the plug. So some things you'd need to, you know, just looking at documentation isn't always brilliant. What's interesting is there are some studies about care bundles, a package of interventions to reduce surgical site infections. And what's really interesting is when you look at these care bundles, you look at the compliance with the care bundles, and compliance is really quite low. For example, we did a study recently where we did it in colorectal, so large bowel surgery, and we had, I think, 200 patients who had the package of interventions, and there were 9 interventions. And of the 200 patients, only, I think, 5 of them got all 9 interventions. So part of the strength of these packages is that it's all these things working together, like a, you know, a symbiotic relationship. Not everybody's getting everything that it should be getting. So we could do more there.
And the message for people who are, you know, perhaps going in for surgery, they've been waiting to have a gallbladder out or a hernia repair or, you know, some of these common operations is take your bed jacket and your favourite fluffy socks, keep warm, make sure you have a shower. Should people be, you know, using these hand gels and things like that?
Yes, I'm always amazed when I visit patients on the ward and they have got a whole stack of kind of toiletries and things next to them for cleaning. I've seen the relatives come in and they're cleaning the down the bed areas, which is terrible that they need to do that. But if that's going to help, then by all means do that. Another thing is the smoking. If you can stop smoking even just for 10 days, for 20 days, for 30 days, that would make a fantastic difference to your chances of getting an infection. So there are lots of things that patients can do.
That was Professor Judith Tanner. While I was at the meeting, I also caught up with Marcel Jaspers, a professor of organic chemistry at the University of Aberdeen. He looks to the future of medical microbiology with bioprospecting, searching for new drugs in extreme environments. For him, this all began by combining work with one of his favourite pastimes.
I was trained as a traditional chemist making synthetic molecules, and when I discovered I could do chemistry and diving at the same time, I decided to find my way to California and work for the guy that was doing this. And ever since, I've fallen in love with the molecules that nature makes and the beautiful activities that they have. Initially, though, I mean, we were thinking about sponges and sea squirts and soft corals as the best source of these unusual molecules. Now it turns out that actually the bacteria inside the sponges make those very interesting molecules. So that's where we're going right now. We're going inside the sponges, we're going to deep trenches, and even to deserts now, which may seem the polar opposite of a deep trench, but still extreme environments seem to give us interesting new chemistry.
What are the sorts of chemicals and compounds that you're finding in these microorganisms in the deep sea and in the desert?
So we're looking for things that are drug-like. So these are small molecules that fall in a certain size range. The key is that we know that most infectious diseases have been treated using natural chemicals. About 70% of all antibiotics are actually from nature still. So it turns out that nature has a good resource of these things, probably for good ecological reasons. And that we've looked in all the traditional sources, like the soil in faraway locations. What we haven't done is looked at under the sea very much. So that's only been done for the last 40 or so years. Also in extreme locations, like I said, deserts or Arctic environment, polar environments. And so by looking at these isolated environments, we're finding new types of biology that give us new types of chemistry.
Why would we do this? I mean, don't we have other ways of finding drugs and small molecules that don't involve kind of diving to extreme levels or traveling into the middle of a harsh desert?
If you look at how the drug industry's functioned over the last few years, they have a number of different ways of finding drugs, and many of them are very, very good. And I think a blend of different types of techniques should be available to the drug industry. But a lot of industry has turned away from nature as a source of drug discovery because they find it too random almost. So they prefer to have a targeted approach to drug discovery. And it turns out that this approach they've had, for instance, high-tech approaches such as combinatorial chemistry, haven't really given us the successes that we were expecting. So now, with an increased understanding of the genetics of how small molecules are produced by nature, we're able to look much more closely at how they're produced, and finding the organisms that are the best or the most talented producers of these very interesting compounds. It turns out that nature still has very much the best way of producing high chemical diversity and populating what we call chemical space. So if you think of a way of representing molecules, then the synthetic molecules that we've used for drugs populate a very small part of that space, whereas nature has populated almost every single part of that space, making it a very good place to look for molecules with new mechanisms of action against infections.
And new mechanisms of action is really the key thing, isn't it? Because we're in a situation now where if we take antibiotics, for example, you know, a lot of those drugs are not working as well as they used to. The organisms that we're looking to target with them are developing resistance, and we've not seen a new antibiotic or new class of antibiotics discovered for a couple of decades now. Do you think this is going to bring us the next big thing in infection control?
What it will give us is new ideas around which we can base new structural classes, I think. Sometimes it's just about saying, well, hey, this is a really interesting molecule. We can modify this in many different ways to find an active principal component that you need for the drug development.
When you find something that looks interesting, what do you do with that? Are you then taking that on and doing chemistry, or are you looking at the organism as a way of producing a new drug or a drug precursor? Is this a synthetic biology type approach? What happens once you've been down to your deep sea trench and look for something interesting in a sponge and found that little moment of, this could lead to something? What happens next?
The first way always, and the drug industry loves, is to make it by chemical synthesis. But for some of these molecules, they're far too complex to do chemical syntheses. What we typically do is we look for analogues in the extract itself and test those to see if there is any cause for thinking that a structure-activity relationship exists, so that there's a relationship between modifying the structure and the activity that we observe. More likely nowadays, we look for the genes that construct these molecules in the organism itself. And by knowing where they are, we can see whether or not they're modifiable. So we have one class of such molecules that are indeed modifiable. They are small cyclic peptides that are increasingly popular with the drug industry right now. They can't make them very well. The mechanisms we have discovered allow us to make analogs of these small cyclic peptides in a myriad of ways, so we can make thousands of compounds in a relatively short order.
So what's special about these organisms living in these extreme environments?
We're looking for things that have evolved differently or in isolated environments. So if you think about ocean trenches, only 1% of the Earth is covered in ocean trenches. They're all separated and maybe down to 10,000, 11,000 meters. So things that go in them don't necessarily come out again. So they're essentially like negative islands. So things that drop down don't come back out again. And they've evolved over very long periods of time under very hostile environments. So they have different biosynthetic pathways that produce different chemistry. We've shown that. In terms of, say, desert environments, the environment is so hostile that things may not actually be active or growing actively very, very fast. So something may have evolved only 1 million years. Evolution may have occurred in what is in fact a 30 million year stretch of time because of the slow growth rate. So again, we're seeing evolutionary remnants sometimes. Sometimes we're seeing things that evolved in hostile environments that have been isolated for a very long time. So again, where evolution has taken a different tack in these places, we often find that there's new chemistry to be found.
Is there anywhere that you haven't explored yet that you'd like to go searching for new microbes and new chemical compounds in?
Yes. I was discussing with my oceanography friends a few weeks ago, and he was telling me about the middle of the Pacific Ocean is the place where least has changed over the last millions of years, because there is essentially no primary productivity in the upper ocean there. Everything that's there is very slow growing, bacterial sedimentation rates are low, that in fact a very thin layer of sediment may represent millions of years of time elapsed, so that even a short core from the middle of the Pacific may give us some really, really interesting biology that we haven't seen before.
So we're talking about very deep ocean there, presumably. I mean, how on earth do you get down to the bottom of the middle of the Pacific Ocean to take a sample?
So the biggest problem is convincing anyone to go out there, because it's not interesting to most oceanographers. Nothing's happened. It's 10 or 12 days to get there by ship, so that's expensive. And like you say, it's difficult to get deep samples. So again, a lot of oceanography ships are equipped to sample down to 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 meters, if you're lucky. However, we're actually developing our own deep sea sampling device that we'll test in the Atacama Trench in September this year with a company called Deep Tech in Dundee. It's a very primitive piece of equipment. It's just a big cable reel with essentially a coring device at the end, and we'll test that to 8,000 meters this autumn. We've made the preparatory visits to Chile, so we know that everything, all the permits are in place. The people there are helping us, are very, very generous, giving their time and their advice. So hopefully in this September we'll have a chance to really collect some sediments from very deep down.
So you won't personally be diving down into those trenches then?
No, I think that my days of diving are essentially over, because I think the much more exciting stuff is not in the shallows, it's going to be in the deep zone. So it's much harder to get down that deep without technical equipment.
Often people say, you know, we know more about space than we do about the deep sea, and perhaps we're not going to find new antibiotics, you know, on the moon or on Mars, but it sounds like there are quite a lot of unexplored environments still to uncover. The middle of the Pacific is one. Is there anywhere else that you think we should be looking for these things?
One place that my friends are getting very excited about in Oregon is the hot smokers. You know, you've got very, very high temperatures very close to them, and that in those zones you might find bacteria that do something interesting. Again, those are protected sites, so you need special permission to go collect. So there are people in the world who are doing this kind of work, but that would be very, very exciting to look at these bacteria.
It should indeed. Professor Marcel Jaspers ending this edition of Micropod on the control of infection. Incidentally, a recent editorial in Environmental Microbiology proposed the creation of new centres to discover and develop chemicals from nature. So we'll be keeping an eye on what happens in the future. Meanwhile, if you're interested in attending our summer conference, check out the Society for Applied Microbiology website for details. I'm Nancy Mendoza, and our next Micropod podcast will be the two winners of our Science Communication Awards. Do join us again soon.